3, 2, 1, liftoff.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Welcome to a History of the Space Race podcast, episode 71. Houston, we've had a problem. Apollo 13 was the third time that NASA tried to land men on the moon. NASA scheduled the launch of Apollo 13 for April 11, 1970, about 5 months after the end of Apollo 12, which put NASA on track for its overarching plan to land on the moon about twice a year after Apollo 11. Mission planning for Apollo 13 focused more than ever on scientific exploration. There were many reasons for this. As I've mentioned before, during the Mercury program, the Gemini program, the Ranger program, the Lunar Orbiter program, and then the early part of the Apollo program, NASA had repeatedly prioritized engineering over science. Basically, the argument was that the agency should focus on proving that a manned landing on the moon could be done. Once that was accomplished, then NASA could turn its engineering know-how to carrying out a scientific mission. Well, by now, Apollo 11 had demonstrated the engineering feasibility of landing men on the moon, and Apollo 12 demonstrated a degree of operational mastery by performing a precision landing on the moon. Now, the bill was coming due for NASA to actually start prioritizing science. Relatedly, having landed on the moon twice now, and the Soviet Union claiming a total disinterest in the moon, NASA needed to justify the continuation of manned landings. Many Americans were starting to wonder why the government was spending so much money on moon landings, especially with domestic unrest and foreign conflicts that the country was engaged in at the time. Scientific exploration that could be conducted only by astronauts was the way NASA could continue to justify the Apollo program's existence. The emphasis on scientific exploration could be seen in the selection of the Apollo 13 landing site. Apollo 13 was to land in the Frau Moro crater, located above the moon's equator on the western side of the moon facing the Earth. The terrain at the Frau Moro crater was rough. Geologists studying photos of the moon speculated that the impact which created the crater had exposed material from early in the moon's history. By studying this area, geologists could learn more about how the moon may have formed, and accordingly, more about the early history of Earth. Getting to the Frau Moro crater, however, required two adjustments to the lunar landing mission profile. First, NASA needed to plan a new flight trajectory for Apollo 13 when it was going to the moon. During the Apollo 11 mission, Apollo 11 had been sent to the moon on a free return trajectory. This meant that if no further adjustment was made to Apollo 11's flight path, it would have simply swung around the moon and boomeranged back to Earth on a return trajectory. A free return trajectory was a safety measure just in case the service module engine failed to fire for any reason. A free return trajectory, however, limited possible landing sites to around the moon's equator. Because the Frau Moro crater was in a higher latitude, Apollo 13 could not be sent to the moon on a free return trajectory. Instead, NASA implemented what was known as the hybrid free return trajectory. Under a hybrid free return trajectory, Apollo 13's initial flight path, as set by the translunar injection burn using the third stage of the Saturn V, the S4B, would be a free return trajectory. On the way to the moon, however, the astronauts would use the service module engine to modify the trajectory to land at the higher latitude. This meant that Apollo 13 would no longer be on a free return path, but the trajectory could in theory always be changed back to a free return using the same service module engine. NASA actually first used the hybrid free return trajectory during Apollo 12, but I'm mentioning it now because this hybrid trajectory becomes much more important in light of what happens during Apollo 13. There was also one other change to the lunar landing mission profile. In the past, the lunar module would undock from the command module and then perform the descent to the lunar surface in two phases. The first phase was the descent orbital insertion, when the lunar module maneuvered itself into a lower orbit. The second phase was the powered descent maneuver. The second phase lasted only about 10 minutes and involved firing the lunar descent engine pretty much the entire time, all the way to the moon's surface. For Apollo 13, NASA planned to use the command and service modules to take the lunar module through the first phase of the descent, the descent orbital insertion maneuver. Only after the command and service modules took the lunar module to the lower altitude would the lunar module undock. The lunar module would then proceed with the powered descent maneuver to land on the moon. NASA decided to change the mission profile in this manner, with the entire Apollo spacecraft stack coming down to the lower altitude to maximize the amount of fuel in the lunar module for the powered descent maneuver. Using the service module engine to bring the lunar module to the lower altitude meant less fuel would be used on the lunar module. Because the terrain in the Frau Moro crater was so rough, the mission planners wanted to give the astronauts in the lunar module as much fuel as possible to hover and identify a flat patch of ground to land on. Once on the surface, the astronauts were to conduct two EVAs lasting about 4 hours each. As with Apollo 12, the first EVA would be spent setting up the American flag and deploying the Apollo Lunar Surface Equipment Package, or ALSEP. And just like Apollo 12, Apollo 13's ALSEP will carry a nuclear reactor with plutonium in it. Incidentally, the nuclear reactor was stored inside a cask capable of withstanding re-entry in the Earth's atmosphere, just in case the launch had to be aborted. This will turn out to be an extremely wise precaution, again because of what is about to happen during Apollo 13. The crew of Apollo 13 selected for this mission included Jim Lovell, the commander, Ken Mattingly, the command module pilot, and Fred Hayes, the lunar module pilot. At this point in NASA's history, Lovell was NASA's most experienced astronaut. And in case you're wondering, Lovell was the one played by Tom Hanks in the 1995 movie. Lovell had flown on Gemini 7, that 14-day-long endurance flight, which at this point was still the record holder for mission duration. He had flown on Gemini 12, that mission where humans saw a solar eclipse in space for the first time. He had also flown on Apollo 8, the first time that any humans had gone all the way to the moon. This also meant that Lovell would be the first human to ever return to the moon with Apollo 13. The two other crew members would both be new to space. Ken Mattingly was a relative latecomer, having been recruited in NASA's fifth class of astronauts in 1965. Fred Hayes was similarly recruited from the fifth class of astronauts in 1965 and had also never been to space before. As with every mission, Apollo 13 also had a backup crew. The backup crew consisted of John Young, the backup commander, Jack Swigert, backup command module pilot, and Charlie Duke, backup lunar module pilot. In the crew rotation system that Deke Slayton had set up, these men were also presumptively slated to serve as the prime crew for Apollo 16. As the backup crew for Apollo 13, however, they naturally worked closely with the prime crew of Apollo 13 and spent a lot of time in close quarters together. This became a problem shortly before launch. On April 5th, 1970, only 6 days before launch, backup lunar module pilot Charlie Duke came down with the measles. In a turn of events that is surprising to no one who has children, Duke contracted the disease from his son, who was 3 years old at the time. This was a problem because Duke had been working closely with the Apollo 13 prime crew only 2 days before, when he was contagious. The flight surgeon immediately took blood samples from all of the other astronauts in the prime crew and the backup crew to determine whether they had developed immunity to the measles. The results showed that everyone else was immune, likely because they had all contracted the measles sometime earlier in their life. Everyone, that is, except for the command module pilot, Ken Mattingly. If Mattingly contracted the disease, the life cycle of the measles meant that he would start showing symptoms right around the time that Apollo 13 was supposed to enter orbit around the moon, and possibly while he was alone inside the command module while Lovell and Hayes were on the moon's surface. The flight surgeon ordered that Mattingly should not fly under these conditions. NASA now had two choices on its hands. NASA could either delay the launch of Apollo 13 until the next launch window in about a month, or they could replace the crew. Delaying the launch was a very unattractive option because it meant significantly increased costs while equipment was just laying around for another month, particularly at a time when NASA's budget was being cut. The second option, to replace the crew, was not free of problems either. Normally, the procedure would be to replace the entire prime crew with the entire backup crew. This was so that the teams, which had been working closely for months, would maintain unit cohesion. But Charlie Duke on the backup team, and the one who had contracted measles in the first place, would not recover in time for the launch. This left NASA and Commander Jim Lovell really with one option. Replace Command Module Pilot Ken Mattingly with Backup Command Module Pilot Jack Swigert. This presented a new problem of unit cohesion, though, since Lovell and Hayes had not been training that closely with Swigert. they needed to make sure that they could work together as a team. Thus, while the astronauts are normally allowed to relax in the 2 days before launch, Lovell, Hayes, and Swikert spent their 2 days before launch in 12-hour sessions inside simulators. By the end of it, though, the three men had shown that they could work smoothly as a team. The only other thing NASA had to take care of now was scratching out Ken Mattingly's name on the plaque attached to the lunar module and to replace it with Jack Swikert to commemorate Apollo 13's landing. The mission control team for Apollo 13 would be led by lead flight director Eugene Krantz, played by Ed Harris in the movie. As lead flight director, Krantz was overall responsible for the direction of the mission, along with his white team. The other flight directors who would rotate in to provide 24-hour coverage were Glenn Looney, head of the black team, Milton Windler, head of the maroon team, and Jerry Griffin, head of the gold team. The final thing to cover before I turn to the mission is the name of the spacecraft. Continuing the tradition, Lovell and his crew got to select the call signs for the command and lunar modules. For the command module, Lovell chose the name Odyssey. Lovell liked this name because it related to the story by Homer as well as the 2001 Space Odyssey. For the lunar module, Lovell chose the name Aquarius, after the Egyptian god who carried water. The lunar module was not named after the song The Age of Aquarius by Fifth Element, which was released in 1969, though the crew did play that song on their Walkman during the mission. On April 11th, 1970, at 2:13 p.m. Eastern Time, Apollo 13 took off.
10, 9, 8, ignition sequence has started. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. We have commission. We have to call at 2:13. Hello, program. Building up to 7.6 million pounds of thrust, and it has cleared the tower.
I will point out now that some people have focused on the number 13 as a bad omen, and that the number doomed the mission from the start. These people also tend to point out that Apollo 13 launched at 13:1300 hours, or 1:13 p.m. But you only get a bunch of 13s if you contort the facts by looking at the time in Houston at launch time, which was Central Time, 1 hour behind Florida Time, Eastern Time, where the actual launch is taking place. This, I think, is just an illustration of how some people can find what they are looking for when they really want to find it. Apollo 13 did, however, encounter a serious problem just 5 minutes and 30 seconds into the launch. By this time, Apollo 13 had jettisoned the first stage of the Saturn V rocket. They were now running on the second stage, S2, powered by 5 J2 engines. Suddenly, engine number 5 turned off. Engine number 5 was also known as the inboard engine because it is located in the center of the other 4 engines. The inboard engine shut off about 2 minutes earlier than planned. A post-flight investigation would show that the Saturn V rocket's guidance system had shut down the engine due to pogo oscillations. Basically, engine number 5 had begun vibrating to the point where the engine was about to reach combustion instability. In fact, the post-flight investigation concluded that had the engine run any longer, combustion instability would have ensued, and the engine would have exploded. With the premature shutdown of engine number 5, mission control directed the remaining 4 engines to burn longer to compensate. Nevertheless, Apollo 13's thrust-to-weight ratio was now thrown off, meaning it ended up in a slightly lower orbit than planned. To compensate for this, mission control directed the astronauts to burn the third stage engine in the S-4B for a little longer to raise Apollo 13's orbital altitude. The mission to the moon itself was not in danger. There was plenty of fuel left in the S-4B for the translunar injection maneuver. After about 2.5 hours in Earth orbit to finish checking out systems, the astronauts fired the S-4B to send Apollo 13 hurtling toward the moon. Following engine shutoff, Swikert undocked the S-4B, then docked and retrieved the lunar module. Mission Control then remotely controlled the S-4B to burn its remaining fuel, sending it on a course to crash on the moon near the site of Apollo 12's landing to gather data for the seismometers left behind by Pete Conrad and Alan Bean. The astronauts then settled into their 3-day journey to the moon. There were a few experiments to perform, such as photographing the moon on their way out. They also modified their trajectory to enter lunar orbit for a landing at the Frau Moro crater, taking the spacecraft stack out of the free return trajectory. During the journey out, there was a very relaxed atmosphere. Mission Control and the astronauts passed the time chatting and joking with one another. For example, Vance Brand, who was acting as Capcom, teased Fred Hayes about his observations of the Earth.
I guess the world will really just turn. I can see some of my land masses now. It must be Australia now near the bottom, and I guess we haven't really figured out what's over the to the west. It must be some part of Asia, China probably.
Hey, maybe the fact that you verified that the Earth really turns, we can call this Hayes' theory, huh?
Very good, Vance. Very good.
The astronauts also learned about the breakup of the Beatles during their regular news update.
See, the Beatles have announced they will no longer perform as a group. The quartet is reported to have made in excess of $500 million during their short musical career. However, rumors that they will use this money to start their own space program are false.
Maybe we could borrow some.
Okay.
Jack Swikert then realized that he had not filed an income tax return, which was due on April 15th, while he would still be in space.
You guys completed your income tax?
How do I apply for an extension? Yeah, Joe, I got a... Hey, that ain't too funny. Things kind of happen real fast down there, and I do need an extension. I didn't get mine filed. I was serious, would you?
You're breaking up the room down
there.
We'll,
I may be spending time in it. I may be spending time in another quarantine besides the one that they planned for me.
We'll see what we can do, Jack. We'll get with recovery and see if we can get the agent out there in the Pacific when you come back.
In case you were wondering, Swikert was entitled to a 60-day extension to file his tax return because he was out of the country. There were also plenty of other jokes about how Mattingly still was not ill after being removed from the mission, as well as a running joke about how Swikert kept having to go to the bathroom and how venting liquid waste into space was slowly changing the spacecraft's trajectory. At 49 hours into the mission, Mission Control went through one of its routine changes in shift. Flight Director Eugene Krantz and his white team came on duty. The task during their shift was to help the astronauts prepare the lunar module, Aquarius, as Apollo 13 was now only about a day away from the moon. At 54 hours and 25 minutes, Fred Hayes opened the tunnel between Odyssey and Aquarius and entered the lunar module. At 55 hours and 15 minutes into the mission, Aquarius was now mostly set up and ready to go. The crew of Apollo 13 started a television broadcast to give everyone on Earth a tour of the spacecraft. By this time, however, Americans had begun to think of landing on the moon as routine, even though this was only the third time that we were sending humans to land on the moon. The result was that none of the networks bothered broadcasting the transmission from Apollo 13. The only people watching were those in Mission Control and people in the guest viewing room next to Mission Control. The broadcast lasted for about 30 minutes. Lovell, who operated the camera, showed the crew and the regular aspects of being in space, like drinking water out of a bag, what the view looked like outside the windows, how they slept in space, and how the tape recorder that they used to play music floated around the cabin. Mission Control did not tell Lovell that the networks were not broadcasting, so Lovell kept talking about showing things to the television audience when there was none watching at all. And about 25 minutes in, Mission Control gave Lovell a gentle nudge to wrap up the broadcast.
Okay, Jim, we're seeing a tape recorder now, and just by the way, how long do you expect to keep the TV on this evening?
As Lovell was about to answer Mission Control's question, he heard a loud bang. Lovell looked around, only to see Fred Hayes with a knowing smile. Hayes had flipped the switch for the cabin pressurization valve for the lunar module. Every time he did this, there was a loud bang, and he enjoyed flipping the switch without warning as a practical joke. With that done, Mission Control now pressed to wrap up the television broadcast going to no one.
Okay, Jim, it's been a real good TV show. We think we ought to conclude it from here now. What do you think?
Roger, sounds good, and this is the crew of Apollo 13. Wishing everybody there a nice evening, and we're just about ready to close out our inspection of Aquarius and get back for a pleasant evening at Odyssey. Good night.
Thank you, 13.
At this point, the astronauts were about to wrap up in anticipation of another rest period. Krantz's white team had also been at their stations for almost an entire shift and expected to be relieved in a little over an hour. Before everyone wrapped up, however, there were a few housekeeping matters. Lovell had to put the camera equipment away. Hayes was busy turning off the computer in the Aquarius in anticipation of spending another night in Odyssey. Meanwhile, the ECOM station in Mission Control asked Capcom to pass along a message telling Swikert inside Odyssey to turn on the fans inside the oxygen tanks on the service module. The ECOM station, that was EECOM, stood for Electronics, Environmental, and Consumables. ECOM was responsible for monitoring electrical power, conditions inside the cabin, and resources like food and water. In the events to follow, ECOM will become a critical station. Manning ECOM on the white team at this time was Cy Liebergott. Liebergott was 34 years old at the time, was initially a contractor working for North American Aviation before he joined NASA in 1964. Liebergott asked that the fans inside the oxygen tanks be turned on to get a better reading of oxygen levels for the service module. The oxygen inside the tanks are held under pressure in a liquid state. As the oxygen is used up and there is less oxygen inside the tank, the oxygen starts to stratify into layers of gas and foam and liquid. As a result, to get a better reading of oxygen levels, Liebergott wanted the tanks stirred to homogenize the oxygen inside the tank. This was done about once a day to get a good reading, and had been done before in the mission without a problem. Because the crew was already busy shutting things down for the night, Capcom told ECOM to hold on until the astronauts were a little less busy. But about 6 minutes after the television broadcast ended, Capcom passed along the message.
13, we've got one more item for you when you get a chance. We'd like you to stir up your cryo tanks.
That in addition,
I have Captain Canyon for a look at the Comet Bennett if you need it.
Meanwhile, inside Mission Control, the different stations were still talking to Flight Director Krantz about navigational and guidance issues. This was all conversation recorded inside the Mission Control Loop in Houston, but none of the astronauts heard the conversations. As was normal, the only messages to the astronauts were passed through Capcom. So, as I play this next audio clip, I want you to keep in mind that the astronauts are not hearing anything that is being said. But from the conversation, you can gather that no one inside Mission Control thought anything was afoot. The only indication of a problem was a sudden loss in communication and telemetry from Apollo 13. You can hear that loss of communication by the sudden rise in static in the audio clip that only lasts about a second.
Okay, let's make sure we get the stir first, George. Can you hang on? He did read it up to them.
Yeah.
Guys, look at your O2 quantities and see if you see a big change.
He can
ECS, he can. enter any stir. You getting stir now on the O2?
Doesn't matter. Might be.
You got a page update up the crew checklist anyway on board, don't you?
Right.
Don't you got a page update? Well, why don't we read it up to them and that'll serve both purposes.
All right.
Both have them entered, as well as why don't you tell them what page you want in the checklist.
Okay.
As you heard near the end there, the mission controllers, particularly Krantz and the Guido officer, continue talking normally after the loss of communication. No one is aware of any problem. Inside Odyssey, however, the astronauts heard a large bang, followed by a sudden fluctuation of power in the command module. They then heard their attitude control thrusters start firing, adding to the noise and the confusion as Odyssey tried to maintain attitude. Lovell initially thought that Hayes was playing a joke again by turning on the lunar module's cabin repressurization valve, but when Lovell looked at Hayes, Hayes gave him a look indicating he had no idea what was happening. Swikert thought maybe that they had been hit by a micrometeoroid, but there was no indication of a leak anywhere in the spacecraft. Then the astronauts reported to Mission Control. Swikert speaks first, and then Lovell takes over.
Flight coming. Go
okay.
We showed the warm overhead hatch is closed, and the heat current looks normal.
Okay.
We got more of a problem.
Okay, listen, you guys.
Flight
we lost fuel cell one
and
two pressure.
We lost O2 tank 2 pressure.
You can see, you want to look at it?
And
yeah,
we've
got a problem.
Okay. Roger. Stand by, they got a problem.
You see a hard drive? You see an O2 bus undervolt there, guys? Or ECOM?
Negative flight.
I believe the crew reported.
We got a main B undervolt.
Okay, flight. We've got some instrumentation flights. Let me add them up.
Roger.
Okay, stand by. 13, we're looking at it.
We may have had an instrumentation problem, flight.
Roger.
What you heard there was Swikert telling Mission Control, "We've had a problem." Capcom then asks Apollo 13 to repeat. Lovell then takes over and reiterates, "Houston, we've had a problem here." Note that this is slightly different than what is said in the Apollo 13 movie, when Tom Hanks said, "Houston, we have a problem." The movie took some literary license. Lovell then says, "We've had a main B bus undervolt." So, to simplify this for understanding, a bus is basically an electrical power distribution unit. So when Lovell says, "We've had a main bus B undervolt," he is saying that their instrumentation is showing a loss of power. What you can hear from Mission Control is Flight Director Krantz asking Liebergott at the ECOM station to confirm. Is Liebergott also seeing a loss of power? Liebergott actually says no, and that they appear to just have an instrumentation problem. In other words, there is a problem with the sensors giving data on the electrical power system, but there was no actual problem with the power system. The next report from the astronauts suggests that perhaps Liebergott was right, and that it was just an instrumentation problem. That was Fred Hayes reporting that the power seemed to be looking fine again. So at this point, no one, neither the astronauts nor anyone in Mission Control, is panicking. No one understands how serious the situation is yet. At the same time that Hayes was speaking, however, there was one other clue about the problem that Apollo 13 was facing. The Instrumentation and Communications Officer in Mission Control, known as INCO, reported to Flight Director Krantz that Apollo 13 had switched from broadcasting on a narrow beam to a wide beam mode right around the time of the reported bang. This might explain the momentary loss of communication and telemetry data from Apollo 13, though it did not explain why the spacecraft had switched broadcast modes. Aboard Apollo 13, the crew started to take precautionary measures. They started to close the tunnel between Odyssey and Aquarius just in case there was a leak somewhere or they needed to make a rapid movement to undock from the lunar module. Hayes then reported more information to Mission Control that appeared to confirm ECOM's initial theory that there was just an instrumentation problem. Hayes was reporting that the sensor to detect oxygen levels in the service module's oxygen tanks appeared to be incorrect, because it was now reading full, even though earlier it was reading between 20 and 60%. Hayes then reported that their instrument panel was showing another problem with Odyssey. So now Hayes was reporting that both electrical power distribution units, main bus A and main bus B, were showing a problem with Odyssey's power. Flight Director Krantz now asks Cy Liebergott at ECOM if he has a recommendation. And Liebergott now reports that he is seeing two of the three fuel cells in the service module are not generating power.
Lady Tom, go ahead. He's got fuel cells 1 and 3 are offline. We've got main A volts. We have no main B volts. Have him attempt to reconnect the fuel cells. Fuel cell 1 to main A, fuel cell 3 to main B.
Okay.
Let's just try that.
One.
Back to main A, fuel cell three, back to main B.
Main A, three to main B.
Let's see what happens.
Liebergott's recommendation is simply to reconnect the two downed fuel cells to the electrical buses. At this time, no one seems to be questioning whether the fuel cells are damaged or perhaps something worse had happened. Capcom passes the message up to Apollo 13 to reconnect the fuel cells. Hayes complies, but he lets Mission Control know that this didn't solve the problem. They're still not getting any power from two of the three fuel cells.
Okay, Houston, I'm John. I tried to reset and fuel cell 1 and 3 are both showing gray flags, but they're both showing zip on the flows.
Even with this report that they are still not getting power from two of the three fuel cells, ECOM is still thinking that this is an instrumentation problem. ECOM had told Flight that the astronauts should connect fuel cell 1 to main bus A and fuel cell 3 to main bus B. When that didn't work to restore power, ECOM's next suggestion was to just reverse the connections. Connect fuel cell 3 to main bus A and fuel cell 1 to main bus B. So at this point, if you were to analogize this situation to calling tech support for your computer, we're still at the stage of checking to make sure the computer is properly plugged in. No one thinks that the fuel cells are actually lost yet. Liebergott does, however, tell Flight that they should start to verify the data they did have on the fuel cells. The fuel cells consumed nitrogen and oxygen, so Liebergott asked Flight to have the astronauts confirm the data shown on their instrument panels about nitrogen and oxygen pressure levels on the fuel tanks feeding to the fuel cells to see if they matched the data that Mission Control was seeing. In short, they were still trying to verify if there was an instrumentation problem. Continuing the investigation, Liebergott now also asked the astronauts to simply disconnect fuel cell 1 from the electrical bus and see what happens to the fuel cell readings. At this point, however, Lovell points out another problem. Their instrument panel shows that one of their two oxygen tanks on the service module is empty. He then looks out the window and says they are venting something. Krantz asks ECOM and others in Mission Control to identify what could possibly be venting from the service module. The obvious answer was the oxygen tank, but nothing was being assumed at this point. What was clear now, finally, however, was that there was a serious situation. This was not an instrumentation problem. Krantz therefore gives a little pep talk now to everyone in Mission Control.
Okay, now let's everybody keep cool. We got the LEM still attached. The LEM spacecraft's good, so if we need to get back home, we got a LEM to do a good portion of it with. Okay, let's make sure that we don't do anything that's going to blow our CSM electrical power with the batteries or that will cause us to lose the main or the fuel cell number 2. Okay, we want to keep the O2 and that kind of stuff working. We'd like to have RCS, but we got the command module system, so we're in good shape if we need to get home. Let's solve the problem, but let's not make it any worse by guessing.
What follows now is a masterclass in troubleshooting to identify and solve a problem. Now that Liebergott, sitting in ECOM, had a pretty strong indication that the situation was not an instrumentation problem, the measures he started to propose became more significant. You see, Liebergott had seen that the sensors were showing oxygen tank 2 was empty, and that the oxygen levels inside tank 1 were falling. But up until now, he had been working based on a theory of an instrumentation error. So he ignored the empty reading on the O2 tank 2 and was looking only at the level in tank 1. And he was assuming that the oxygen level in tank 2 must be something similar to tank 1. But now that the astronauts had reported that they were venting a gas into space, it was not much of a leap to make the connection that the gas must be from the oxygen tanks. That would explain why the level in oxygen tank 1 was falling. The bang that the astronauts heard could also be an explosion in tank 2, which would explain why that tank was reading empty. And a loss of one of the oxygen tanks could also explain why two of the fuel cells were reportedly dead. The fuel cells ran on oxygen. Liebergott, now assuming that the sensors were telling him exactly what was happening, saw a dire situation. One of the two oxygen tanks was lost. The oxygen levels in the remaining tank, tank number 1, were falling. Two of the three fuel cells were dead, but the last fuel cell was still eating out the remaining limited supply of oxygen. On top of all this, Odyssey's batteries had turned on to keep the spacecraft powered after the loss of the two fuel cells. If the two fuel cells were really dead, that battery power would need to be saved for re-entry, or the astronauts wouldn't make it home. So, Liebergott now made an important decision to power down whatever was not needed on Odyssey to start conserving battery power and reduce the consumption of oxygen from the last fuel cell. In fact, Liebergott started recommending turning off equipment that Odyssey would need to support the moon landing. And so at this point, Crantz started holding off, telling Liebergott that they should wait until they better understood the situation. And now Liebergott gives it to Crantz straight.
Well, the thing that concerns me is throwing equipment. We had a problem. We don't know the cause of the problem.
Flight, I've got a feeling we've lost two fuel cells. I hate to put it that way, but I don't know why we've lost them. It doesn't all tag up.
And it's not an instrumentation problem,
the best I can tell right now.
Okay, I'll tell you what, let's discuss this for just a little bit longer there, Cy. Capcom, start them moving back towards the TTC attitude.
Okay,
let's start them going in
for
the rate capping. I feel it's going to be a relatively long period of time to try and nail down the problem. Go ahead.
The first person you heard there was Crantz, and then Liebergott there jumps in and says he believes that they've lost two of the three fuel cells. Liebergott's belief that two of the three fuel cells were now lost had significant implications for Apollo 13. Mission rules dictated that the moon landing could proceed with only all three fuel cells working. Because Liebergott believed two of the fuel cells were already dead, in his mind, there could be no moon landing. So shutting down systems that were required for a moon landing didn't matter. It would just save them precious power. Crantz, however, was not quite ready to accept that conclusion. As Mission Control worked with the astronauts to shut off more and more systems to conserve power, they were able to turn off one of the batteries to save that power. But Liebergott remained concerned about the level in Oxygen Tank 1. The pressure was continuing to fall. That could be because Oxygen Tank 1 was still feeding the last remaining fuel cell, but it could also be a sign of a leak. Taking no chances, Liebergott now asked to isolate the surge tank, which would have some residual oxygen inside it, to save that oxygen for re-entry.
ECS Econ, is that search tank going down?
Roger that.
Okay. Flight Econ?
Go Econ.
Let's have them isolate the search tank also and save it. We use prayer as much as we can.
Say that again?
Let's isolate the search tank.
Why that?
Command module.
I don't understand that, sir.
I want to use the cryo as much as possible.
But that would seem to be the opposite, if you want to keep the fuel cell going.
The fuel cells are fed off the tanks in the service module flight. The surge tank is in the command module.
We need the surge tank.
We want to save the surge tank in between each re-entry.
Okay, I'm with you.
Roger.
Capcom, let's also isolate the surge tank.
Sorry, what are you doing for me to get a heater?
Okay, you want to isolate the surge tank.
That's the next step, Larry. We got get some power on main
A. What we're doing is securing our entry systems right now.
Okay, 26.87, huh?
Right.
13 Houston, we'd like you to isolate your O2 surge tank. Over.
Hey, O2 tank 1.
This was an action that will save the lives of the astronauts. At the same time that Liebergott was trying to save an emergency supply of oxygen for re-entry, he was also trying to investigate why the pressure was falling inside Oxygen Tank 1. Mission Control had been working to divert what little power they could to heat Oxygen Tank 1, hoping that would increase pressure. If the pressure increased after heating the tank, that might show that the tank was still whole, since the tank was holding on to the higher pressure. but as they heated the tank, the pressure kept falling. Liebergott then asked that the fan for oxygen tank 1 be turned on as well to see if that would improve the reading. It did not. The pressure in oxygen tank 1 kept falling. So now, about 48 minutes after the explosion, Liebergott starts making an even more extreme call. The astronauts need to get to the lunar module before Odyssey ran out of oxygen. He didn't think that oxygen tank 1 could be saved.
The pressure in O2 tank 1 is all the way down to 297. You better think about getting in the LEM or using the LEM system. I'm going to have to power way down. I don't know if I'm going to be able to save the O2 for the third fuel cell, or fuel cell 2 rather.
Still, Krantz wasn't ready. He wanted to check everything, so now he asked Liebergott to see if there was any issue with any circuit breaker that should be checked. In the meantime, however, Krantz asked the controller sitting at the TELMU station, that's Telemetry, Electrical, and EVA Mobility Unit Officer, which was the equivalent of the ECOM person for the lunar module, to start figuring out how to run Aquarius at minimum power if the astronauts needed to use it as a lifeboat. Continuing to work the problem, Liebergott was trying to identify the source of the oxygen leak. He concluded that it was possible the leak was actually coming from fuel cell 3, one of the two dead fuel cells. The pressure reading from this fuel cell was completely gone, zero, unlike fuel cell 1, which still had some pressure left in it. Fuel cell 3 was also connected to oxygen tank 2, which was totally empty. So, applying this logic, he surmised that perhaps the leak was just inside fuel cell 3, and that a leak there had caused the loss of oxygen in tank 2. So now Liebergott asked Krantz to test the theory by shutting off the valve to fuel cell 3. Again, by shutting off the valves to one of the fuel cells, they would be killing the possibility of a moon landing, because mission rules required all three fuel cells. But by now, Krantz was in full agreement that at least fuel cell 3 was totally dead anyways. So he directed Capcom to tell the astronauts to shut the valve to fuel cell 3. Now, Liebergott's theory was not perfect. It did not explain why there was a problem with fuel cell 1 if there was a leak in fuel cell 3. But they were working to check every theory that seemed reasonably supported by the data in front of them. About 57 hours into the mission, and a little over an hour after Apollo 13 started experiencing problems, Krantz noted that the next shift of mission controllers was coming on board, and they would need to change places soon to give fresh eyes a chance to look at the problem as well. No one was going home at this point, though. Krantz's white team was going to look at the logs, starting with the initial problem, to investigate what had gone wrong and advise on next steps. Glenn Looney and the black team were taking over. Meanwhile, the pressure inside oxygen tank 1 continued to drop despite turning the valve to fuel cell 3 off. So now, mission control tells Apollo 13 to turn the valve on the other dead fuel cell 1, off as well, in the hopes that that would stop the apparent leak in the last remaining oxygen tank. About 10 minutes after turning off that valve, however, the oxygen levels continued to drop. And at the rate the pressure was dropping, there was probably only 40 minutes of oxygen left in the tank. Both Mission Control and the astronauts were now thinking about moving to the Aquarius to use it as a lifeboat.
Well, Tom, looks like we've got about 40 minutes left in that tank.
Okay, does it look like it's still going down?
That's affirmative, yes.
It's slowly going to zero, and we're starting to think about landing lifeboat.
What does he read on board?
Now,
that's what we're thinking about, too.
What we know now is that Oxygen Tank 2 on the service module had, in fact, exploded. The explosion was caused by a short circuit in exposed wires powering the fan inside Oxygen Tank 2. A set of defective thermostatic switches had allowed a part of the oxygen tank to heat to dangerous levels, which in turn likely damaged insulation on wiring. The damaged insulation eventually led to a short circuit and a spark, causing a fire in the oxygen tank that built pressure until Oxygen Tank 2 exploded. That explosion blew out an exterior panel on the service module, throwing out one of the antennas, which caused a 2-second loss of communication between Mission Control and Apollo 13. The explosion also damaged Oxygen Tank 1, causing the leak there, as well as damage to fuel cells 1 and 3. Apollo 13 was now totally in the hands of Mission Control, and more specifically, the flight director in charge. Over time, NASA had developed a rule that a flight director's word during a mission is supreme. No one can overrule the flight director unless the flight director was fired on the spot. Thus, during an accident like the one Apollo 13 is facing, not even the President of the United States had the ability to overrule the flight director's decisions. The decision now by Flight Director Glenn Looney to use Aquarius as a lifeboat did not come out of nowhere. Since the Apollo 9 mission, when NASA first flew a command and lunar module into space at the same time, NASA's mission planners had examined the possibility of using the lunar module as a lifeboat in an emergency. They had also simulated the use of the lunar module as a lifeboat in preparation for Apollo 10. And in Krantz's speech, which he gave only about 15 to 20 minutes after the accident, telling the white team to focus on, quote, working the problem, Krantz had already suggested that the lunar module could be used as a lifeboat. At 57 hours and 41 minutes into the mission, a little under 2 hours after the accident, Mission Control officially ordered the astronauts to get into the lunar module. Mission Control had accepted that Odyssey was about to die. What oxygen was left in the surge tank and power that remained in the batteries had to be saved for re-entry. What follows from the decision to use the lunar module as a lifeboat is another masterclass example, this time illustrating how to triage problems to manage a crisis. The problems that Apollo 13 now faced can be grouped into two large categories. First, how to get the astronauts home, and second, how to make sure the astronauts had the supplies they needed, such as air, water, and power, so that they would be alive when they made it home. The getting home part of the problem was the most urgent. The need to conserve battery power in Odyssey meant the navigational computer had to be turned off right up until they were preparing for re-entry. But turning the navigational computer off would mean losing all navigational data, including data about Apollo 13's attitude. If the astronauts didn't have attitude data, they wouldn't know which way the spacecraft was pointing to make course adjustments. And remember, as of right now, Apollo 13 is not on a free return trajectory. Because they had been headed to the Frau Moro crater, they had used the service module engine to modify their flight path. They would not be going home unless they adjusted their trajectory soon. So the first thing that the astronauts had to do was save the navigational data in the Odyssey's computer. Fortunately for them, they did have another computer in the lunar module on Aquarius. Unfortunately, there were two problems. First was getting the data from Odyssey's computer into Aquarius's computer. Not only did the astronauts not have Wi-Fi or any sort of wireless data transfer, they also had no way to physically connect the two computers. So, Jim Lovell pulled out a pencil and paper and started writing down all the information on Odyssey's instrument panel. One error, one transposition, one misplaced number, or one poorly written number could spell doom. The second problem with getting data from Odyssey into Aquarius was that the spacecraft were facing in opposite directions. In their docked formation, the command and lunar modules are attached to each other from the top of the spacecraft. This meant that all of the attitude data had to be converted to account for the fact that Aquarius's orientation was totally opposite of Odyssey's orientation. Once again, a single error here could mean doom. Once the navigational data was successfully transferred, manually, from Odyssey to Aquarius, the next step was figuring out the path that Apollo 13 should take to get back home. The responsibility for solving this problem fell on the shoulders of the retro officer. As I mentioned in the episode on Apollo 11, retro is responsible for planning retrofire times and abort plans. The retrofire officer who served during the Apollo 11 landing, Chuck Dietrich, was now given the task of figuring out how to bring Apollo 13 home. There were two theoretical options. The first option was a direct abort. Apollo 13 would fire its engines to turn around and come home immediately. The second option was the indirect abort, using a free return trajectory that went around the moon. When Dietrich looked at the situation, however, there was realistically only one option, an indirect abort using a free return trajectory around the moon. A direct abort would have required the astronauts to fire the service module engine, but Mission Control now accepted that an explosion had occurred in the service module. There was no telling what damage that explosion had caused, and what might happen if they tried to turn the service module engine on. For all intents and purposes, the service module engine was dead and should only be used if there was absolutely no other option. Moreover, the firing of the service module engine would require the use of Odyssey's computer, and more power than they could spare given what they needed to reserve for re-entry. This left the free return trajectory. But Apollo 13 wasn't on a free return trajectory at the time. So now the question was how to move the spacecraft back to a free return trajectory. Since the service module engine was not an option, the only other option remaining was Aquarius's descent stage engine. Maneuvering the Apollo spacecraft stack from the lunar module, however, was unprecedented. Basically, this meant the stack would have to fly backwards, with the much lighter lunar module trying to maneuver the much heavier command and service modules, with an engine that put out a lot less thrust than the service module engine. Mission Control needed to come up with a whole new procedure to fly the lunar module in this reverse configuration. At 61 and a half hours into the mission, still before Apollo 13 had rounded the moon, Lovell and Hayes turned on the lunar module's descent engine for a 35-second burn. This burn put them back on a free return trajectory to Earth. Normally, the astronauts would have checked the attitude readings on their spacecraft during a burn using the stars that they could see outside the windows to confirm that they were on the right track. Lovell reported, however, that the debris from the explosion caused twinkling all around them and prevented them from reliably identifying any stars. Shortly after the burn, Mission Control passed up a new schedule to allow the astronauts to get some rest. Remember that just before the accident, they were planning to enter a rest period in about an hour. It was now nearly 6 hours since the accident, and none of them had rested. Everyone was getting exhausted, and Mission Control wanted to make sure the astronauts were set up on a rest schedule. In the meantime, Mission Control continued to work the problem. Apollo 13 was now on its way home, but the situation was far from ideal. On the current course and speed, Apollo 13 would come home in about 4 days' time and would land in the Indian Ocean. Mission Control wanted to speed up Apollo 13's journey as much as possible to bring the astronauts home quickly and to ensure that Apollo 13 would still have adequate power, oxygen, and other supplies for re-entry. The current trajectory would also have Odyssey splash down in the Indian Ocean, where the United States had fewer recovery ships. The ideal would be to land somewhere in the Pacific Ocean, where far more recovery vessels were available. To shorten the journey home, Mission Control decided to prepare for another burn using the lunar module's engine. Although the lunar module engine was not as powerful as the service module engine, they could make very good use of the available thrust by turning the engine on at the right time near the Paracynthian, when Apollo 13 was furthest from the Earth near the apex of its parabolic trajectory. This option would shorten the journey home by about 12 hours, and have Odyssey land in the Pacific Ocean. There was also one other idea called the super fast return option. This idea called for jettisoning the service module before conducting the burn. The service module was presumably dead anyways, and as I noted earlier, no one wanted to risk using the service module engine. Dropping the service module before the burn would shave off some 36 hours from the return journey and would have Odyssey splash down in the Pacific Ocean. But dropping the service module had one serious drawback. It meant that the heat shield at the bottom of Odyssey, the command module, would now be exposed to space for an extended period of time. The heat shield was not designed to be exposed like that. If something punched a hole in the heat shield while it was exposed, such as debris from the explosion that was still floating around them, that would prevent re-entry. There were also concerns about maintaining proper attitude during and after the burn if the service module was dropped. So, Mission Control ultimately decided against jettisoning the service module. At 77 hours into the mission, about 21 hours since the accident, Mission Control lost contact with Apollo 13 as Apollo 13 went behind the moon. As Apollo 13 continued past the moon, it reached a distance of about 248,655 miles from Earth, which to this day is the record for the farthest that any human has traveled from Earth. As Apollo 13 came back into radio contact, the crew began preparing Aquarius for the next long burn to shorten the journey home. The astronauts needed to work quickly. The lunar module only operated on battery power, unlike the command module, which had fuel cells. Normally, this did not present a problem, since the lunar module would only be used for about 2 days. But now the lunar module had to last at least 3.5 days. And to do the burn, they would need to power up the lunar module's computer and other systems. The longer they kept these systems on, and the longer they took to do the burn, the less power they would have for other things, like maintaining environmental control inside the lunar module, where all three astronauts were now sheltering. At about 79.5 hours into the mission, Lovell conducted a 4.5-minute burn using Aquarius's engine. As I said earlier, normally astronauts would use stars to confirm the attitude readings on their instrument panel to ensure that they were thrusting in the right direction. With the debris outside the spacecraft, this wasn't possible, so Lovell used the moon. Mission Control had told him that the moon should be visible outside the commander's window inside Aquarius during the burn. When the burn was over, it was almost perfect. There would be a couple more burns later on to correct the spacecraft's drift, but Apollo 13 was now on track to come home. At this point, Apollo 13 was looking pretty decent on the getting home part of the problem. Now, attention focused on solving the second part of the problem, making sure the astronauts had the consumables they needed, like oxygen, water, and power, so they would still be alive when they got home. The fundamental problem here was that the lunar module had only been designed to sustain two astronauts for about 45 hours for a lunar surface mission. But now, Aquarius was being used as a lifeboat, and it needed to sustain three astronauts for 4 days. The resources on Aquarius needed to be stretched. The most pressing consumables problem was the air. Oxygen actually wasn't an issue. Aquarius had enough to sustain all three astronauts all the way home. The problem was removing the CO2 created from breathing the air. Both the lunar module and the command module used canisters of lithium hydroxide, also known as CO2 scrubbers, to remove carbon dioxide from the air. The problem was that the lunar module only had enough canisters to support two astronauts for 45 hours. There were more CO2 scrubber canisters in the command module, enough to make it home, but the command module's canisters were in the shape of a cube. The lunar module's canisters were cylindrical. The canisters were not compatible. This was the result of the command and lunar modules being designed by two different companies, North American Aviation and Grumman. The contractors did not ensure compatibility between the two spacecraft unless NASA specifically asked for it. So now, Mission Control needed to figure out how the astronauts could literally fit a square peg into a round hole. At 80 hours and 30 minutes into the mission, Hayes reported that Aquarius's CO2 alarm had activated, but it would be another 10 hours before Mission Control passed up a solution to the astronauts. They gave detailed instructions for building an adapter to plug one of the command module CO2 scrubbers into the lunar module using whatever was available, including duct tape, plastic bag covers, and the cover ripped from a procedures manual. The engineers on the ground who had developed the prototype had to write out how they built this adapter with specific step-by-step instructions, which Capcom then gave to the astronauts one at a time. Imagine trying to tell someone to put together a piece of IKEA furniture using mismatched parts over the phone without any pictures, and that's roughly what they are doing here. Here is just one part of the instruction to give you a flavor of what was going on.
Okay, now then, we want you to take the tape and cut out two pieces about 3 feet long or a good arm's length. And what we want you to do with them is to make two belts around the sides of the canister. Belt near the top and one belt near the bottom with the sticky side out. Wrap it around, sticky side out as tight as possible. It'll probably take both of you to get it nice and snug, over.
And then a little later.
Fine. The next step now is to anchor that tape, and the way we want you to do that is to cut about a 2 foot length off the roll and then tear it lengthwise so that you have two strips about 2 feet long and about a half an inch wide. And you'll wrap those around the canister at right angles, more or less, to the tape that you've got, so that it goes across the top and across the bottom. And when it goes across the top and the bottom, put it so that it's outboard of the center hole, and try to get it over one of the ridges between the screens so that it won't block the flow. Is that clear, over?
The next big problem to tackle was the power. As I said, Aquarius had only batteries, not fuel cells, and these batteries were only intended to last about 2 days. So, to keep power available as long as possible, the astronauts had turned off every system they could, including environmental control. This was problematic as the lunar module was not insulated at all, and its walls were far thinner than those in the command module. Temperatures inside Aquarius fell to 38 degrees Fahrenheit, or about 3 degrees Celsius. The cold temperatures, in combination with the water in the air breathed out by the astronauts, caused water to start to condense on the walls, making Aquarius a very uncomfortable lifeboat. As Apollo 13 was on its way back to Earth, there was one final problem that had to be solved. How could the command module be turned back on for re-entry? At this point, none of the three fuel cells would work. All they had now for power was what remained in the batteries, and the batteries weren't full. Some of the power had been tapped after the fuel cells died, and Mission Control was trying to investigate the problem. Moreover, the command module was never intended to be turned off and back on during flight. The amount of power drawn during power-up used more power than was available to the astronauts. The responsibility for solving this problem fell to the shoulders of ECOM officer John Aaron. The same John Aaron who had given the famous SCE to auxiliary instruction during Apollo 12. Aaron and a team of others came up with a new procedure for turning on the command module in a specific sequence and at specific times to reduce power consumption. They also decided to transfer power from the batteries in Aquarius to top up the batteries on Odyssey. The equipment was never designed for power transfers between the command and lunar modules, so Aaron and his team had to come up with a whole new procedure on the fly to achieve this. At 136 hours into the mission, and only about 6 hours away from re-entry, the astronauts began to power up Odyssey. As with last time when the astronauts transferred to Aquarius, they now needed to take the attitude data from Aquarius and manually convert and transfer that data back into Odyssey. After powering up Odyssey successfully, they jettisoned the service module. As the service module passed by their window, this was the first time that the astronauts could see the damage caused by the explosion. Lovell and Hayes described the scene as follows.
And there's one whole side of that spacecraft missing.
Is that right?
Right by the, look out there, would you? Right by the high gate antenna, the whole panel is blown out, almost from the, base
to
the engine. Copy that. How you doing in RCSR control? I see it's coming down.
It's coming down. We're going to let it go just a little bit longer.
Yeah, it looks like it got to the SCS.
Looks like he's got the data he needs.
Okay, if he's through with the photos,
we can stabilize out here.
Wait,
he's stabilized now, it looks like, right?
Okay.
Really
a mess.
During the last part of that description, Hayes mentioned seeing that the service module engine was struck by debris. This seemed to confirm the wisdom of not trying to turn on the service module engine again. About 141 hours and 30 minutes into the mission, about an hour and a half before re-entry, it was now time to jettison the lunar module, Aquarius. Normally, when the lunar module is separated from the command module, the service module is used to back the command module away. In this case, however, they had already jettisoned the service module. And even if they still had the service module, Mission Control was not comfortable firing any of the thrusters on the service module after the explosion. Without the service module, there was now no thrusters to push Aquarius and Odyssey apart after undocking. In anticipation of this problem, NASA had reached out to universities for help. NASA wanted to know how much air pressure should be built up in the docking tunnel between Aquarius and Odyssey before undocking. The plan was to use that air pressure to separate the two spacecraft once the docking clamps were released. So, with that information, the astronauts pressurized the tunnel, and when they released the docking clamps, Aquarius and Odyssey naturally drifted apart. Aquarius would later re-enter the atmosphere and mostly burn up, except for one very important piece of equipment. Remember that Aquarius had been carrying the Apollo Lunar Surface Experiment Package, which contained a nuclear reactor with plutonium. That reactor was encased in a canister that could survive re-entry, which it did. The canister landed in the Pacific Ocean and sank into the Tonga Trench. Odyssey was now set for re-entry, but there were still concerns. Odyssey was coming back at a rather shallow trajectory. It was possible that Odyssey could simply skip off the atmosphere, in which case the astronauts would be lost forever. Mission Control could have gotten their math wrong, and Odyssey could be coming in too steep and burn up. About 15 minutes after re-entry began, Swikert and Lovell say what is essentially a goodbye in case things go badly. During re-entry, there is normally a period of communications blackout due to the plasma generated by the heat of re-entry. Due to the shallow trajectory of Apollo 13's re-entry angle, Apollo 13 had the longest communications blackout of any Apollo mission, at around 6 minutes, creating a momentary fear in some that perhaps the heat shield had failed. But shortly thereafter, aircraft acquired Apollo 13 coming down from the sky, and recovery teams moved in. After 6 days, the crew of Apollo 13 successfully returned home on April 17, 1970. Lovell, Hayes, and Swikert were picked up by the USS Iwo Jima. Since Lovell and Hayes never landed on the moon, none of them were required to enter quarantine. After staying one night in Hawaii and meeting President Nixon, they were allowed to go home. As for the command module, Odyssey was sadly later disassembled for testing and then put into storage. But today you can see Odyssey restored at the Cosmosphere Museum in Hutchinson, Kansas. Apollo 13 had engrossed the world's attention, even more so than Apollo 11 had. An estimated 1 billion people had been following the mission after the accident. Because of the successful recovery of the crew, Apollo 13 has been called NASA's finest hour. And in many ways, it was. But it was an hour with significant consequences on the future of manned spaceflight in the United States. And the Soviet Union would use the accident to emphasize the benefits of its own purportedly unmanned program to explore the moon. But I'll talk about that next time.